I always, you know, try to get to know the crew and all the people around because they're working their butts off as well. Approaching something that's so much bigger than what you are and what you even know that you are capable of, just really be prepared. Try and work as hard or harder than everyone else. Be nice, and your work will speak for itself.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free, educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we are joined by Americana solo artist and member of the Smashing Pumpkins since 2015, Katie Cole. Today we'll be learning how to sing Oh Darling by the Beatles without ruining our vocal cords, what it's like stepping out to play a sold-out show at Madison Square Gardens, how a Smashing Pumpkins luxury tour bus compares to Katie's previous tour vehicle that run up 50,000 kilometres on the clock, and how Chopin can shape our collective approach to songwriting. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is Melbourne's finest export, Katie Cole. Thanks for joining us today, Katie. How's it going?
That was a remarkable introduction. Going very, very well. It's extremely hot and humid here in Nashville, and in no way have I acclimated to the weather here. I'm used to Melbourne weather where it's like overcast and rainy and all that stuff, and does not get to these levels of heat. But doing well.
Good, good, good. Now, my sister actually lives in Melbourne, and there's a place in a little area in Melbourne called Fitzroy, which I visited, which has loads of kind of
very
bars
trendy.
And
very hip.
What do you miss of Melbourne, maybe from the music scene or, you know, apart from your family and friends, I'm sure? What is it specifically you miss since you've moved to America from Melbourne?
Coffee. It's always the I don't know what it is. To me, it's, I don't know whether it's the water or the milk. I still haven't worked out that magic thing. Like, obviously, if you're in New York, like, you get a bagel in New York and there's nothing like a New York bagel or a New York slice of pizza. And I always wondered if that was like the water thing there and the way that it goes into the, for me, it's like, I'll get off a plane and I haven't been back to Melbourne in, wow, it's been 2.5 years. It's almost 3 years, obviously, you know, since the pandemic is, you know, no traveling, no anything. But that's always the first thing I do when I get off the plane. Even if I'm just in the airport, I go right to the coffee stall, and I'm like, just give me all of your caffeine and delicious products.
And did you used to play a lot of gigs in Melbourne? Because I know you were writing and you created your own website, and that's how you got spotted and end up going over to America. Were you playing a lot of gigs in Melbourne in the early days? And what kind of venues were you playing, and are they still in existence, do you know?
I played a lot. Let's use all of the vowels and all the consonants for that. That was really my upbringing in Melbourne. I played, you know, 4 to 7 gigs a week. It was very extensive for a very, very long time. I started doing that when I was about, 15 or 16, and that just continued on and on and on and on and on and on. And these were like 3-hour shows, and most of these shows were me bringing my own PA and lighting and all that stuff. So they were not easy to just show up and play a couple songs. It was like, no, you're playing for 3 hours and here's this, you know, get good and be good now. I think most of those venues probably still exist. I don't know, because I've played at so many venues that you can't, that's a really long list to go through. But most of these were clubs, pubs, restaurants, not really huge venues, but just these were the venues that paid me to play. So I was just thankful to have a job being able to do something creative. So my day job was, you know, writing songs and whatever, and my day job at night was playing songs. So that was it. But I couldn't tell you if those venues are still there. I have no idea.
Now, I know that you were raised by your single mother in kind of a working class part of Melbourne, and I know that she had a series of different part-time jobs to kind of make ends meet, and you've referred to her as your role model. Now, I wonder, like, how did, you know, your mum feel about you going into the music industry? Because I think, you know, we have a lot of young musicians listening to this, and as a theme over the 100-odd episodes we've done of this, is that the parents play quite, their view about their child going to the music industry plays quite a pivotal role in whether they go down that route or not. So what was the relationship between, you know, your mum, music, and the idea of you going into the music industry or not?
Well, I suppose I have to start by saying that, like, I grew up in, like, the extremely musical family thing. Her playing a role was from being born because, like, me and my sister grew up with both of our parents playing, you know, playing piano and singing, and everyone was kind of creative. My mum always, still to this day, cranks music. Like, she, a lot of the time she'll pick a day of the week and it might be like a Saturday or Sunday, and she like opens up all the windows of the house and just blasts whatever record, it might be Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd or something, and she shares her music with the neighborhood quite freely. So I grew up with that, and my dad's side of the family was more the Chopin and classical music. There was always music. It wasn't even a question until I suppose I'd hang out with friends, whatever, and then it'd be like, let's play a board game. And I'm like, why aren't we listening to music? So it was always there. So when I actively started playing live shows, my sister started going to a more musical, she moved to go to a more musical high school, and I started playing live gigs at, you know, a very young age, and I'd perform in like her high school concerts as well as my own. It was always there. So the active decision to continue to do what I was already doing, I think she was always supportive of it. She just saw it as just like the logical next step. It wasn't like, hey, mum, I'm going to go into music. It's like, hey, I'm already doing this thing. How's it going? Do you want to come to my gigs? So that was really it. It was just an extension of something that was already happening that we were very much raised with.
That's a great position to be in, because I think a lot of people aren't actually in that position, and some are kind of put under pressure to go to certain places, universities, and get other careers and just do this as a side job. But the fact that you were developing your skills during the day as part of your day job, as you refer to, and then obviously in the evening kind of getting paid for it is fantastic. If COVID hadn't have happened in the last year, so we're recording this in June 2021, and I know people listen to this podcast years after we release it, but recording this in June 2021, what do you think how would the last year have panned out for you professionally? And obviously, there's many negatives that have gone with what's happened, but can you pull out one or two positives that have actually come out of the last year at all?
Well, I've discussed this a little bit. I think, 2020 was a massive learning curve for everybody in every field, but with creative people, we were very much forced to address and pivot and adapt. And I've always been pretty proactive with the way I handle my career and what I'm doing, and if something's not working, I'm able to actively pivot, adapt, all those things anyway. So I sort of watched when things were starting to sort of, you know, quote unquote, fall apart pretty dramatically and rapidly. In March, everyone had all their gigs cancelled and whatnot, and I've discussed with in other interviews as well how I just sat back and watched for the first couple of weeks on what everyone was doing, because rather than react to a situation, I think it's always smarter to assess and act so that you're making a logical choice based on the right information and you're doing things for the right reason. So I pivoted to doing online concerts, themed and by requests concerts. So I moved to doing, like, I did a couple of shows that were predominantly my songs on a platform called Stage It. And I, you know, threw in a couple of covers, and then I thought, I knew immediately after, I think it was my second concert, I was like, I need to adapt this into something that will not tire. Because I don't know, it's not like, I don't think poorly of myself in terms of people will get bored with my material, but I thought a way to keep people engaged is to have them request songs and make things an exciting experience. And like, so I moved into doing like 80s and movie songs and 60s soul. I did a Halloween show. I just did like all these, so that rather than it just being this same sort of thing, it's still me, it's still, because I mean, part of your performance is personality and performance. So showcasing the songs, your talent, your songwriting, but your personality. And people, I knew more than anything else, people were going to be craving engagement more than, like, everyone, of course, just went, you know, wild on social media and just became more active doing things. But as we all know, social media is extremely addictive, and it can be a very lonely place to see like everyone, because everyone puts the best of themselves out there, the best photo, that we're all having a great time. We're in lockdown, but we're having margaritas, whatever it is. And I know that that can be alienating because you watch what's happening on social media and that's not real life. That's also people staging photographs and doing things. And most of the people that are posting the best situations or best photos of themselves are still miserable and still going through what everyone else is going through. So I opted to go to that platform, stage it, to get it off social media so that there was no distractions. It could be a concert experience. You're tuning in, and I made it so that it was pay whatever you want for tickets, so people could pay like a dollar if that's what they had. I'm like, great. I don't care. It was just, let's all get together and have a good time and forget about the world for an hour. And that really became a strong bonding experience with my audience. So my positives were really, this is a really long answer, I'm aware of that. I am answering your question, I swear.
It's great.
And the positives really were for the performance side of thing, were developing stronger bonds and relationships with people and giving people something to look forward to, and knowing that it was something that I could look forward to for myself as a performer, but something that I'm giving back to people, that here's something, you can have this experience, you can hear this random crazy song that you've requested, and you know, I can read all the chats and comments that come through as we're doing this in live in real time, and see the result, and you know, see the screenshots and clips that people post after the fact, and that they had a good time. So that was one thing. I went into some songwriting. Some of that was quite challenging, like knowing that, oh, I can turn to this and whatever. But then the immense pressure of going, you know, you don't have that many avenues that you can turn to right now. Songwriting's one of them. So be good at it right now. That's part of the internal pressure. And obviously artists put more pressure on themselves and are probably, you know, all of us are extremely self-critical because that's what we do. I did write quite a fair bit and started to sort of, you know, work out what I wanted to do for my next project. And, you know, we'll get into that discussion a little bit later, I suppose, on where we're at right now with that. But I pivoted more to the engagement with things and just trying to give back, and I still managed to film a video and release some songs during the pandemic, which, you know, you had to adapt a little bit for that. Like one of the videos that I released for a song called Hands Tied, like I originally had this idea for it that it would be like walking down like downtown in Nashville, but like kind of lit with like kind of a spotlight. So it was kind of like dark, but like lit, but just felt, I wanted it to feel really urban and sort of social but alienating at the same time. And I had to scrap that idea because I'm like, well, half the people that if I do shoot on a main street, half the people are going to be wearing masks. And that's the wrong type of alienating. Like the idea of listening to music and watching music videos is to escape and see something, you know, from a different place and time. And, you know, I didn't want to deal with that. So we ended up just adapting the video and the way we shot that. But I still managed to get music out there that I wanted to release. And I mean, there's always positives. I learned a lot more about myself and what I'm able to do. I'm glad that I took the reins the way that I did. I think a lot of people got very scared. A lot of creative people got very scared when all their touring got cancelled. And I was one of them. But I thankfully, again, sat back, planned, thought about what I was going to do, and then executed what I thought was the best avenue for me and my audience and how to continue to build that.
Well, adaptability has been a key enabler in your career, I think. And, you know, that's really great that you managed to kind of approach that with that strategic thinking, really. You said once that my voice memo section on my phone is always in use. I'm interested, how many song ideas do you currently have on your voice memos? And has that increased in the last year or decreased?
Oh, it's this running list of ideas. I mean, most of the voice memos that are currently on my phone are the ones that are literally like the early stages of ideas. Like once I actually get them off my phone and start writing them, I end up moving them out of the voice memos thing, because otherwise you end up, you know, downloading them, or when you upgrade or sync to your computer or whatever, it's just like, here's 5 gig of information. And it's me just humming along. I've always got literally hundreds of ideas just sitting there. And I'll occasionally skim back through them to dig out things that I maybe may have overlooked. But at any given time, like once they move from the voice memos, I move them into sort of my more computer situation where I'll start sort of, you know, more working through the ideas so they become more than a work tape, and I start to, you know, develop, you know, verse chorus or title concept chorus, something like that. Then I'll move them into like a folder in my Dropbox, which is just like ideas, and it might be like good ideas, band ideas, scale back ideas. I don't know what this is. And like I've got all these multiple folders of things to things that are just basically the next level up from me just having this one sort of idea for a thing. But I also have like a bunch of Word documents that I used to start when every month, because I might not remember what the name of an idea is that I'm working on, but I'll know when I started working on it. Like, so I've got my own very, very strange filing system for song ideas, but you know, I'll migrate the songs over each month that I haven't quite finished, where I feel like I'll look over these lyrics or whatever it is and I'll be like, oh, there's something there. Ugh. So I'll copy paste that over to like the next month of documents that I open. But all these things kind of like sometimes it'll be, I'll have a great song title and a bit of lyric for something, and then I'll have this bit of whatever it is on my phone, and I'm waving my arms around a lot when I talk. If you're listening to this via audio, people that are listening, yes, I am waving. Just picture that. I do wave my arms around a lot when I'm talking. Helps me express myself. But I'll have the lyric concepts, and then sometimes I'll have like the melodic ideas, and sometimes it's like, here's this melodic idea, and then I'll open up like a Word document and read something and marry the two together. Like this melody is sort of, you know, maybe it's kind of melancholy in a way, and I'll read this lyric and I'll be like, oh, that works with that. So sometimes I'll be working, I don't know that I'm actually working on the same thing until I kind of pay attention to it, and or I'll come up with a new melody or a new chord progression and I'll be like, oh, that reminds me of that thing I was writing the other day, but you know.
And the chord, and that's what I was going to come to around the chord. So have you ever got to a stage where you've listened back to something you recorded months and months ago and you have to kind of work out what the chords were that you were playing, or in your kind of, you know, your Word documents, you've written out the chords as well? Or how does that work? Is it just by ear that you work out what the chords are retrospectively?
Oh yeah, it's really just by ear. And again, like if I generally, like if I feel like very strongly about an idea, I'll work on it. I mean, it may not be immediately, but it'll be like within a month or something like that. I'll sort of get to it and pick at it and work on it. And basically just push the boundaries of where it's at to see if it will develop into something bigger in that time frame. Now, you know, some songs I'll sit down to write and they'll just be the entire thing, but some songs it's a work in progress that I don't realize is a work in progress until I, again, yeah, I'll retrospectively go back and retroactively go back and work out what the chords were. And then once I have like the lyric portion, or at least part of the lyric portion, then I'll be like, I'll write notes on all the lyrics that I've got for it. So it'll be like, you know, capo on the third fret, and I'll write down a few of the chords so that I immediately can pull that up and be like, oh, it's that. I have all these little systems, and I really think that it comes down to working out what works for you. I have a very good memory, but if I am working on several things at the same time, I also know it's best just to write down, even if it's just like what capo placement on the guitar, and that's obviously the thing that bars the fret that basically brings up the key a semitone or a full tone, or so, you know, so forth as you go up the fretboard on a guitar. But I'll generally write down things like that and a couple of the chords of like the verse and chorus, and that will be enough for me to go, oh yeah, it's that. Yeah.
How do you ensure that a song is finished in your own mind? So something we get a lot from, again, young musicians who contact us, like they find it very difficult to finish a song, as in they'll do a final mix and they'll listen to it with fresh ears the next day and they're like, want to tweak that a little bit, actually we want this to be, you know, and it's very difficult to kind of go, right, that is the final call. I guess a producer in that situation would help, because they perhaps make that decision for you. Do you have that, have you ever had that experience yourself, and how do you kind of go, right, that's it, I'm not going to tweak this song anymore, it's time to move on?
I have that a lot. I've come to sort of that point in my songwriting career where if the song is not what it needs to be in basically scaled back format, as in like acoustic vocal, piano vocal, whatever it is your instrument is that you're using. And usually for me, the basics of that might be, yeah, guitar vocal, or maybe guitar vocal background vocals, or piano guitar background vocals, or something like that, or some terrible drum loop in the thing. If in its most skeletal format, if it's not where it needs to be there, it will never improve by taking it into the next level of pre-production. So it should be written, like your rewrites should be done at that level, not as this may work for other people, but like it will complicate the situation if you're not already set on where your song is in the song format. I mean, you can listen to somebody's terrible work tape and you can go, that song is amazing. Whereas you can play someone incredible sounding demo and you'd be like, oh, that song's really good. But if I heard it at a work tape format, I might be like, that's okay. You can impress people with all the bells and whistles and you can make something that's, you know, okay, good. You can do that. That's easy to do. But to make something that's great, fantastic, that's the goal for me. And I can see where my flaws are as a songwriter when things are still scaled back. So I usually take my most initiative on rewriting and rewriting, and sometimes it's version 3, version 4, version 5 on the song, the lyrics, whatever it is. Then I'll be like, okay, this is the best version of where the song is, and I'll feel comfortable with that, and then I will share it with my producer. Or if he just doesn't hear what I hear, I will go into, you know, sort of pre-production demo mode, and I will demo it up even further with, you know, if it's a more band song, I'll, you know, play this electric and put, you know, create the drums where they need to be, play bass on it, play guitar, you know, more piano, do some background vocals, whatever it is it needs to do to, you know, if I say to someone, yeah, it's this song, but I hear it more like Elton John. Sometimes you have to hear the Elton John to go, I hear what you're doing with that. Some songs you can hear it as it is and you're like, I totally get that. I could get it. But sometimes it's like, you need a little bit of that on there. But again, until the song is written to the best possible format, I will never move it into that next stage until I'm really set on it. And then as you start to explore further with that and pre-production, which is really the stage you get to before you go into the, like, the real studio with real musicians and so forth. It's basically trying on the outfit to go, does this work? That's how I see it. And it should improve the way that the song is. It should always make the song better, bigger, brighter, whatever it is, or darker, bigger, scarier, whatever your goal is for it. So if I go into pre-production and I start demoing things out, then I can have those bigger discussions with my producer, Howard Welling, and go, is this long enough? Does this get weird enough? And we have those discussions then of, does this song need a solo? Does this song need a longer bridge? Does this song need a blah, 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 blah? And then I will go back into the rewriting process of going, like with a song of mine called Graceland that I had on my...
Great song.
It's a brilliant song. No, it's a great song, but I'm using it as an example because it's a... you know, kind of more soul scaled sort of song. I got to a point in the song where I was like, but my favorite sort of Motown sort of songs have those big sort of modulations or solos, or they have these big brass sections and they have gospel vocals. And I'm like, I got to write this into the song. Like, for instance, a good example I was using in my mind, and it's not a similar song at all, but it was just a good example for this, is if you think of the song Respect by Aretha Franklin, mm-hmm. She'll go into that section after the second verse. It has a modulation and goes into the brass solo, and it's a modulation and it has a big solo in it. And then when it comes back down out of that, you're like, whoa, it's like a massive lift because it's a key change and a modulation. And then it comes back down to this next section and it just resets the whole song. And it's just like, whoa, that's what I felt. I'd love to add that to my song Graceland. So I went back and wrote in the brass section, the key change.
Oh,
some of those big sort of Otis Redding key changes where it hits these sort of really wild sevenths in these different keys. And I was like, okay. And then I also went back into, once I'd written that section into the song, so I already had the song, I already had the way it was going to sound, then it was like, but it needs to, if it's going to legit fit into this thing, it needs to be exciting. So I wrote those sections in, and then it was, well, I want gospel vocals. So then I wrote the background vocal sections into it to the best possible. I mean, I love writing background vocal parts. It's something I'm very comfortable and familiar with. But knowing that these bigger voices were going to be taking these sections, and that I would be sitting on top of them singing these sections. And I was very excited about that, because having those tonal differences in voices is very exciting as a listener to listen to. And it's also exciting for me because I don't get the luxury of having other people sing on my songs all the time. It's usually just me going, okay, I'm wearing a hat now. Does that sound different? So that's something I did. Wrote that solo section of brass instruments into the song, and wrote the gospel parts into the song so that they could elevate and progress in dynamics as the song progressed onwards. And then when you actually have that demoed out in that right format, then you go into the studio and then you're working with the brass instruments and then you're working with the gospel vocals, and they bring their expertise that next level. So that, again, that great thing becomes fantastic. Whereas if I hadn't done all that work, you know, all those versions, all those rewrites and versions, and seeing what I really wanted to do with the song, and what, even as I was demoing it out, going, it's not enough. And you can rely on musicians to bring their expertise to the table and, you know, play a solo here or take some initiative there. But if I don't hear it in pre-production format, if it's not exciting to me and it doesn't do that, all that stuff that I want it to do, you have to kind of take your pride or whatever it is out of the equation and go, what else can I do as a songwriter? And that's when I'll come back and just assess things again. Songs are a work in progress. I usually know at the pre-production stage, like, I've already done all the rewrites. Then it's pre-production, as in like starting to demo things out. I usually know exactly where I'm at when I'm doing that. And once I've done that first round of that, it will usually be exactly where it needs to be. Or if it's not exactly where it needs to be, then I'll go back and write. But I will never go into the studio not knowing that I need that thing to be done. It needs to be done. Then I can go into the studio. Otherwise, it's you're leaving things up to chance. The only things you want to leave up to chance are a musician's ability, not the creative decisions that they're making.
That's a great answer, and thank you. And think about times when you've, you know, had a very particular song that's special to you, and you really want to nail the vocal for this date. What needs to be in place for you to really thrive in that situation? So are you someone who, you know, needs to a producer to say, okay, this is going to be the take? Or is it a case that we're going to keep the take rolling over and we'll get a good take in a moment? So what, you know, if you think back to maybe some of the best, you've got a very beautiful, distinctive voice, what the best performances you've done, what's been the kind of 2 or 3 minutes beforehand that has got you into a position to nail that vocal?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I've got a few approaches. A lot of the time, again, because I've rewritten these songs and I've sat with these, most of these songs, I'm not just like, oh, I wrote this, let's go cut it and, you know, see what happens. I'm not that person. I have to, you know, I've sat with it, I've rewritten, I've sung it. Sometimes I've already sung it live a bunch of times, like doing acoustic shows or whatever it is. But I've usually sat with the song for X amount of time, so I'm comfortable with that aspect, like the song. It's familiar to me. And being comfortable with a song, I've learned now, plays a massive role in the way that my producer sort of helped to sort of kick me into gear for some songs where I really need to stretch the muscle of what I'm doing vocally. For instance, I'll keep on the idea of Graceland because that's a good one. I had that song for a little while and I'd sat on it, I'd played it live and whatever it is. And I hadn't written those key changes in there. I hadn't written the solo into it. And once I'd done that and we went into the studio, my producer Howard was just kind of just like, you know, he would say things to me like, I'm in the studio, I've sung it, we've got through the things, but it's just like I need to get out of my own head because I'm already familiar with it. I've sung it, you know, a bunch of times. I'm familiar with the way it goes. And some songs, you sing them and that's just how they go. But songs where, again, if I'm emulating something that is Motown or that or soul, I need to be kind of, I need to be singing. I need to be, and there's no other way to put it. I need to be getting out of that. So rather than just singing the chorus as the chorus, he was pushing me to get out of the time signature that's stuck in your head. Get out of the tempo, because I'm very, you know, I'm very, very much a metronome when I play and sing. I'm used to it because I've done it for so long. It's just like he's, you know, he was telling me to push against that note, bend that note, stretch that note out a little bit, like play with the pitch of it, you know, just to, there's a big difference between having this perfect performance and having a performance that is emotional. And sometimes in the studio, I'll get stuck in my head and I'll have to sing it out until I was already comfortable with that song, but sing it out until I'm now really feeling it. I'm feeling it in a different way. I'm now struggling, I'm pushing against things, and I'm stretching what I'm doing. So it's not usual for me. It's not comfortable for me. But if I've done it enough times, I've sung through enough takes, then it becomes comfortable for me. And I'm like, oh, I can sing like that. Or I can sing that part. Or I can hit that note. Whereas if you just go through the motions of singing something, that to me, that's just that difference of having a producer that goes, I know you may not know that you're capable of this thing yet, but I know you can do this. You just need to find it, you know. So I will spend, you know, an extra 10 or 20 takes sometimes pushing out a part to get there. Some vocals may just come in and just do a couple of takes of a song and it's done. And I've got songs like that, but certain songs where I need to push the emotional part and the emotion has to tie into those notes of like it, that Graceland song is, if I, you know, it goes into a chorus and I'm just pushing against a note rather than it just being, oh, comfortable in my range and chorus, chorus, chorus. Whereas another song off that EP, Time on My Hands, was like two or three takes singing right through, dimmed the lights a little bit just because I could purposefully not just read the lyrics that were there because I knew the song really well, but if there's lyrics there, you just stare at them and be like, bah, you know, just so I could feel it a bit more and close my eyes and whatever. But just to sing through that, and it was just like, and it wasn't a matter of under-singing, but it was don't try to sing it. For a song like that where it just needed to be sort of a bit more tender, emotional and fragile, when you're really comfortable with singing a song and you're familiar with it, sometimes you'll just sing it. And Graceland, for instance, as a juxtaposition, needed to be sung with confidence. It needed to be bombastic in moments and it needed to show you some hurt. Whereas Time on My Hands is a song that's hurt / fragile, which means singing through a story and making you feel it. Like, okay, here's a good example. I like to tell stories about stories. Excellent. So this is the inception of stories. I've learned when you do acoustic concerts, sometimes if the audience isn't fully engaged in what you're doing, sometimes the best thing to do is to get quieter so they'll lean into you.
Nice.
Because they want to know what's going on. If all of a sudden you get quiet, people shut up, they stop talking, they go. And that's like, I know that's dead space and dead air for you right now, but it works. For certain songs, if they're going to be more fragile and emotional, get quieter. Nice. And people do the work, they do the work for you. So there's a little, you know, there's little tricks that you learn here and there, but working with a great producer that can help nudge you out of your comfort zones and also be the person to be like, no, we've got it. So that I'm not like, just one more, one more take. Because I will sometimes be that person that like I'm literally beating a dead horse and he's just like, no, we've got it. I already know. This is the take I want. I heard it. I felt it. This is the one. It's not perfect, but that's the one.
The answer to this next question may well be it depends on the song. But when you are going in to record a vocal for a beautiful song such as Graceland or Time on My Hands, as you mentioned, what do you want to be thinking during the recording? Do you want to be lost in the lyrics or do you want to be focused on your technique? Do you want to be not thinking about either of those things? Are you kind of doing a DVD running commentary at the time thinking, okay, yeah, that sounds good, or that quite didn't sound so good in the verse before, so I don't know whether we're going to keep this take, but I'll carry on doing it? Or do you want to just be completely immersed in the song? So, because we're getting into the area of red light syndrome a little bit here, and often people going into the studio and recording on a studio, you know, producer time, they can really overthink things. So what's your aim when you go into record? What do you want to be thinking about during those 3 or 4 minutes?
Yes, all of those things. It really is a balance of all those things. I wish there was a simple answer to be like, oh, I just think this and I just try my best. It depends on the song. Like some songs like I'll, you know, just try something randomly with like a little run or whatever it is, or I'll push against the time signature a little bit so that this little bit comes out of time a little bit, or this word's a bit slower than the other word or the other sort of, you know, the demo version or whatever. And I'll be like, oh, I just like the way that feels, or it captures my attention. Sometimes I'll be thinking about the tone and making sure that I hit gravel in my voice, which I don't have much of, so I have to physically put it there. But I'll want to hit gravel on this one word because it makes it emotional, or it makes it angry for the right reason, or it shows that I'm kind of, you know, annoyed or whatever it is. And then there's songs that, like, again, I'll sing the majority of it through it and we'll come back and punch in just for this one section, because it's like I've gotten through the verse and I have to sing it all through in like one take or whatever. Then we'll come back and punch in the bridge so that I can focus on it more. And I'm not halfway through the bridge thinking about the chorus that I need to sing that's much higher or whatever it is. So sometimes it's just the way to get the most out of the take that you've got, and to be honest with yourself, like, oh, I didn't feel it or I didn't get it. You know, and being okay with it, going, oh, I just need to do a couple more or whatever it is. Or sometimes, again, like sometimes I'll leave it up to my producer to be like, yeah, but, you know, this one's technically better, but I like the other one. I felt it more. You know, so having another set of ears, if I was self-producing, you know, I obviously self-produce a lot of stuff for YouTube and all that stuff, and I keep a lot of that stuff extremely live and very sparse and very bare bones so that it can just be what it is, and it's not me laboring over something. I never want stuff to, whether it's my professional stuff or my live stuff, to ever sound like it's being labored over. If it sounds like it's being labored over or too precise or too perfect or whatever it is, sometimes the realness in it and the humanity is kind of sucked out. And obviously that's, you know, one thing I don't necessarily like about auto-tune. For a lot of people, will just go through and just graphically tune everything so it's all perfect and whatever it is. There's a time and a place to, like, if one note is just a bit wackadoo, sure, change the one note, adjust it. If it's the perfect performance and this one note is just a bit bum, sure. I'm not that person. Like, a bit of makeup and a bit of a filter here and there, if something's already good, I'm okay with that. I'm not precious about that. And I know that back in, you know, Whitney Houston's day and other people's days, you didn't have that luxury. But if it's like, this is the take, but that one note, I'm okay with that. I think it's just really more than anything, recording is just getting out of your head. When you think about things too much, it'll convey in the performance. You want to be thinking just enough to be focused on the thing that you're doing, but it shouldn't sound labored over. I think that's really the goal with everything, I think.
Nice. Now, in a bit, we're going to talk about some kind of real career peak in regards to gigs, but there's a lot of musicians who stop playing after a certain period of time because they may play a slightly demoralizing gig. So I'm going to ask you, in your career, what's the most demoralizing gig that you ever played? Tell us about that and you know, how you carried on through that.
Oh, I've done lots of them. I played in pubs, clubs and restaurants for years, and it was just, you know, that was my job. You kind of just take it. I remember playing in a trio and we're in like an hour out of Melbourne in this pub and whatever it is, and people were smashing beer bottles on the ground, like very close to the stage, and it was like, okay, you know, you get through the set and you just like, you know, do I want to go back out there? No. But am I going to? Yes. You know, or when there's no barricade between the band that's playing and people that are dancing. So You've got that thing of when you're a guitarist, you do not have a free hand. You're playing guitar, you've got two hands. I'm not playing high guitar. I'm not a high guitarist, but I'm showing you so you can see my hands playing air guitar up high. When you're playing guitar, you don't have a free hand to grab the mic stand if it's heading towards you, if someone's fallen onto the stage. And that's been a case a couple of times where I've seen someone dancing, moving, you know, being, you know, very Australian and inebriated beyond comprehension, leaning into the microphone, and it's like basically, you know, it's an inch away from smashing my teeth. Right. And like you think about things like that and you're like, okay. But I did a lot of gigs like that growing up, and, you know, there's no other way to say it, but like it's the right and wrong analogy, but that's how I cut my teeth. That's how I got stronger. That's how I learned how to sing through this, you know, the issue, the room, how to work out who's going to be trouble in the room, who's not, who's paying attention, who's a total creeper, you know, all those things. You work out people, and that, you know, that's been one of the biggest gifts that I've ever received. Like those demoralizing, difficult, challenging gigs, or gigs where it's just like playing for hours. And like I'm on gig 7 of the week, and I can see my fingers are physically worn down. You know, the calluses have worn down and my fingers are hurting so much that I can barely play, but I have to play. You know, I've done those gigs. I've done enough of them. I've sang when I've been extremely ill, you know, because I need to, you know, buy food and live. I've done all those things, but it made me stronger. It made me, you know, realize that, you know, of course I didn't have to do any of those things. It was stupid to do some of those things that I've done, but it makes you a better, overall, it made me a better performer and a better artist.
What stopped you from stopping, out of interest? What was the root cause of that? You know, because that's very important to capture.
A lot of the gigs that I played were regular gigs. I've got to go back there again next week. So, you know, it's a bad night. It's a hard night. Or like before smoking was banned, it's like there were bars that were like, you know, I'd play like, I think it was five? 5:30 to 8:30 gig. And then I had another gig that was 10:30 to 1:30 in the morning. And the 10:30 to 1:30 in the morning gig, and these were on the same night, this was a Friday, and that solo gig was just like a room full of smoke. And, you know, and then you'd be driving home with like the windows open going, I can't breathe. But nothing was ever, I was never horribly injured or horribly hurt, or it never got to me emotionally, because it was such a long, you know, long period of time and a big part of my life. And, you know, it showed me what I could do as a musician, what songs I liked, how to interact with very challenging audiences, and just how to overcome everything. So I can't, you know, you have to take the good with the bad with those things, because they make you who you are. And I'm proud of the things that I got through. And I look back on it now and I'm like, I would never want to do some of that stuff again. But I did at the time. And I think it made me a more complete artist, because I cut my teeth doing this. I didn't come out of some, you know, music university or conservatory and just go straight into the, I need more music in my monitor. It's like, I didn't have monitors through most of these gigs. I was listening to myself like way out the front in the middle of the room somewhere and going, it makes you a better musician to hear. It's like, I know I can play any gig to anyone at any time because I've done all that stuff. It's familiar to me. I know what I'd prefer, but because I've had the ability now to have, you know, in-ears like I'm wearing right now, or to have, you know, great monitoring and a great sound engineer that gives you everything you want to hear. But I know how to do it when I have nothing, so it's fine.
And one of the things that gives us confidence with adaptability is knowing that you can deal with lots of different things that can come your way, and really earned your stripes. And now, you know, you're playing Madison Square Gardens and huge venues like that. Tell us about Dublin Castle. So for anyone who's listening to this, they probably do know, have heard of Dublin Castle in Camden. Anyone in the UK certainly probably has either been there or listened or kind of know of the venue. Is it true that you came across to the UK and started playing at Dublin Castle, and then you were kind of really shocked that like people sing along to your songs? That must have been such a surreal experience.
Well, yeah, I took a chance on a radio plugger when I just moved to Los Angeles, and he was, you know, plugging for BBC, and his niche market was breaking American artists. And I had a couple of really good solid radio hits on BBC Radio 2, and he kind of let me know very quickly that it was an unusual thing and it didn't really happen with independent artists, that, you know, those spots were very much reserved for label artists or well-known artists or so, you know, so and so. And I was like, okay, well, I've got to book some shows over there. I've got to introduce myself to these listeners and make the most out of this situation. So booked some acoustic shows over there, and one of them was at Dublin Castle. I think that was my favorite show out of the three that I did over there. And yeah, I was, you know, when I got to the, you know, the songs that they knew that were on the radio and they were singing along, and I was just like, whoa, you know, it blew my mind, because like in America, I just started, you know, my American career. Because when you move overseas, anybody that's ever had a big sea change like that, or it's the same as if you move across country or whatever it is, but you're very much starting again, like whatever it is that you've built up before or whatever, it's like, it doesn't really matter so much. Oh, I also do my own sound effects, clearly. But it doesn't really mean anything. You start from scratch and whatever it is. So I was starting from scratch in America, and then to have, you know, these big strides in the UK and to go over there and be like, whoa. And the American audiences didn't really get that I had national radio in the UK, and that was a very big deal. They were just like, oh, it's not America though. It's like, okay. That was very, you know, obviously that was a victory for me. I was very excited about having those people sing along to my songs, and it was a, you know, a realization and an affirmation that I was on the right path, I suppose, to have those little victories happening. And at that time I'd opened some shows for Glen Campbell and I'd recorded with him, and I just had all these things were happening all at once, and it was very like, oh, okay, I have a career now.
The 27th of August 2014, you did a post on Instagram saying how excited you were to share a stage supporting Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins, hashtag wow. Now, out of interest, we talked about adaptability and that kind of thing, and did you think about did you pick songs from your repertoire that you think would most suit Billy's audience in that situation? So Wycy, who you would have met because she's part of Noel Gallagher's band when you toured with them, she said that when she supported Mary J. Blige, she immediately went, right, crumbs, I've got to pick the songs that I think would, out of my repertoire, that most kind of suit her audience to kind of get them on board quickly. Did that cross your mind at all, or was it a case that you're just going to be, no, I'm going to do...
It didn't cross my mind. What did cross my mind is I did need a connection point. You always need a way to win over the audience. You always need something to be able to bridge that gap. And one way to do that is to pick songs out of your repertoire that mirror or are familiar to the audience that you're playing to. But I do what I do, and the songs are what they are, and you can interpret them, especially if they're more scaled back. Like when I opened that show for Billy, I had an additional guitarist with me and a bass player with me. So they're very much scaled back. You can interpret an acoustic or scaled back song however you want. Like you don't have to hear it as Americana or country or pop or rock or whatever it is. When something's sort of stripped back a bit, you go, oh, I just hear the song. So that was a wonderful introduction to his audience. What I did do is grab a New Order cover and threw an acoustic version of a New Order song into my set. And I watched, like, it was very strategic, but I picked a song. I mean, I grew up listening to everything. I'm a huge 80s nut. I love everything about the 80s.
Was it Blue Monday? Is it Blue Monday you did?
No, I played Bizarre Love Triangle gig. Nice. I've covered True Faith. And actually, it was True Faith. I covered, okay, True Faith, that gig. I have to remember because I've covered a lot of songs. I've covered all the songs by everyone.
I thought I saw yesterday you'd done a cover of Blue Monday, but I might have got it wrong.
No, I just put it in my feed when I was. I'll get to that in a sec. But I covered True Faith, and I watched, like, you can see people's faces when you're playing a show for the most part. And it was an outdoor gig in a sort of, had outdoor seating that was sort of covered. Then there was a grassed area. So it was a pavilion. So it's an outdoor sort of thing. A wine and cheese crowd, if you will. But I could see their faces dramatically change when I played the song, like, ah. And then from that point onwards, they were really listening to my stories. Because, like, I think a way to convert your audience, but to engage your audience is to be engaging. Tell them stories. Tell them something about yourself. Tell them something interesting that bridges the gap so the music doesn't have to do all the work. And the music should do most of the work, but if I've told like an interesting story or something humorous, or I've made it seem like, oh, I'm like, I am you. I am you. We are the same. We have the same existence. We're all the same people. I'm self-deprecating and tell ridiculous stories. And then I play a song, you're probably going to listen a bit more. If I then tell a ridiculous story and play a New Order song, you're going to go, oh, she likes the same music I do. Then you're listening to the rest of the songs with a different set of ears. So that was my plan. I've always been, you know, pretty chatty on the microphone for gigs that I do. More band, you know, if I'm playing with a full band, I talk less. But acoustic shows, I really think that people are there for a show, and whether the show is the music or the show is you telling a story, that's totally your call. And for me, I kind of, you know, play both sides of that. But Blue Monday, to circle back to that, I recently had a Kickstarter that was very successful, and one of my goals for Kickstarter was if I got to a certain tier level, a certain goal, I would change the vinyl color from standard black into blue. So that was something I posted about that. So I made a little Reels video on Instagram, which is like TikTok, but, you know, less terrifying to Blue Monday. So it's just a very blue sort of video. But I'm a huge fan of that sort of music. And if it wasn't for, you know, David Bowie and Eurythmics and a bunch of those people, I wouldn't be the songwriter that I am. And I'm not a product of just listening to one genre. I listen to, again, the musical family that I had, we listen to everything. So that all goes in, and it makes complete sense for me to go, I can play my Americana songs alongside, you know, Bob Dylan, or alongside, you know, it doesn't, I don't see the separation.
Let's pretend a young musician is listening to this and gets invited to open on a huge tour, first leg of a huge tour for a massive international Grammy-winning band. And then it kind of morphs into the fact that they're asked to play bass with that band. How should that person approach kind of the mental side of it and the technical side of it to very quickly have to get into the position playing something not that familiar in the way that it was needed to be successful for a huge, huge international band? How would you deal with that? How should you go about that?
This is a really interesting hypothetical. Hypothetically, if this artist's name was Katie Cole, and if the Grammy award-winning band was hypothetically the Smashing Pumpkins, what I would hypothetically suggest would be, I mean, it went from being asked to open the tour after I did that solo show with Billy. It was the following year. He was putting together an acoustic, sort of, you know, semi-acoustic tour, and was going to be playing songs from across his repertoire, from his songs to other bands that he'd been in and Smashing Pumpkins songs. And it was, you know, an extreme honor to be asked to open those shows. Again, knowing my music is not alternative rock, but again, when things are scaled back, as I was explaining earlier, people can interpret the songs for whatever they want them to be. And I love that. So I was, of course, just, yes, I'll do whatever, you whatever. And then it evolved into, do you also want to play bass on this, you know, this tour? And I was like, well, I've played bass a few times. I'm a metronome on guitar. Like I'm a very rhythmic guitarist. Yeah, okay. And again, it's a bass, it's four strings, it's two less strings than guitar. It should technically be easier. That's my logic in that. And, you know, digging into these songs, I was like, oh, these are hard, you know. And, you know, as you know, with Smashing Pumpkins, and like I covered their songs, you know, in cover bands and all sorts of things in my career, which is hilarious, you know, and amazing all at once. But their songs are not four chord songs. They're not standard verse, chorus, whatever it is. They're verse, other verse, chorus-ish, chorus two, bridge, half bit bar here, key change, solo, verse three and a half. It's like the arrangements for their songs are totally insane and make sense to the band. And when you have to think about them and write them down or learn them, it's like, whoa, okay. So it was quite a task to sort of take on. And, you know, it was very overwhelming and exciting to be given these double roles to play. And it was amazing. And the biggest gift in the situation was that first year when I was opening and playing bass, because we did the tour the following year as well, but it was a bigger leg of the tour, which I'll get to in a sec. But that first year when I was opening and playing, it was very much like, this is the worst analogy. I'm full of analogies today and none of them are good. But the analogy of like, when you go to a car showroom and there's the supermodel that's standing next to the car and it's like, you come with the car, you know, like putting the two to get to together. When people saw me play my songs and then they saw me up on stage with the band, it just glued together as this, the fans just got it. They got it and were like, oh, and they understood my music more. And then, you know, from the start of that tour, by the end of the tour, I'd garnered all these fans that got what I was doing. And like, you know, of course they bought, you know, records on the road and signed records and hands and postcards and faces or whatever it is that you do. But by the end of that tour, it was like, oh, this is really special. And then the second leg of the tour, which was the following year, Jimmy Chamberlain, the original drummer, came back to play some shows. And James Iha, the original guitarist, came back to play a few shows. Jimmy played all the shows and James came back to play the key cities, which were LA, New York, Chicago. And like, I'm there on bass. The song, you know, the songs are much more intricate. I'm playing, you know, it's a longer show. It's a bigger deal. I'm playing these songs like, and was watching the band kind of reforming in a way in front of my eyes and in front of the audience in these more intimate shows, because the shows were, say, the size of I'm trying to think of the equivalent, but they were like good size theater shows. So it wasn't like the audience wasn't like way down there like you are when you're in an arena. It was like they were slightly closer, so you could see their reactions. You could see what was happening.
A song that I wrote with Miss Courtney Love for the Celebrity Skin Album by Hole, Miss Katie Cole.
Billy also asked if I wanted to sing lead on a couple of songs during those shows too, because he'd co-written a bunch of songs with Hole, with Courtney Love for Hole. And so I sang Malibu, and I also sang most of the lead in a song of Smashing Pumpkins called Stand Inside Your Love. And people, I wasn't opening those shows, Liz Phair was, but people saw me playing bass and then singing lead and going, whoa. And I played, you know, some acoustic in those shows too. And it was just this huge development. And as I was like, I think I was second week into that tour, I was like, I saw what was happening with the fans. I saw the engagement, you know, dramatically increase. And I launched a crowdfund during that tour, which I don't suggest anyone ever does if you're not able to stop. And I just thought, I didn't plan for it. I didn't know the tour was going to be so big and I didn't know the engagement was going to be so big. But I was like, if I don't engage with fans to support what I'm doing and what I'm about to do next, it's a lost opportunity, I think. So I launched a crowdfunder during that tour, which was successful. And that's what ended up becoming the Things That Break Part 1 EP and subsequent songs that I've released after that, which were part of that project. I had a wonderful time on that tour, and I think the hardest thing about approaching something that's so much bigger than what you are and what you even know that you are capable of is just, you know, be prepared. The hardest thing about being a musician is making it look easy. And, you know, whatever stresses of the day or whatever it is, whatever, just leave that all behind and just show up and be prepared. If you haven't slept much or whatever it is, you know, the whole idea is that I want to be a professional, play the songs well, do my job, be a pleasure to be around, get to know all the staff and all the crew and all the management, and be a professional in every level, so that when people think about you or interact with you, they have nothing but positive things to say. You know, you might have a hard night or whatever it is. I'm still a guest in this situation. I'm still, you know, and it's not that I haven't earned my ticket to be on those stages, so to speak, but I'm very lucky to be where I am. There's, you know, millions of people that can play instruments the way I do or whatever it is. But what makes me is that I am an artist. I'm also bringing something else to the table. I'm a lead vocalist and I sing and work with Billy Corgan and his voice the way that no one else, as far as I can tell so far, has done with him. Like, I sing with him, not over him, not on top of him. I, you know, anticipate what he's doing as a vocalist, and he's an exceptional vocalist. And people see him as just like the front guy, and he's a ripping guitarist. He's unbelievable. But what he does as a vocalist, he has a range that very few people do. And he uses all of it in so many songs that until you're singing along with him, you're like, whoa. Yeah, that's, for me, being a lead vocalist, and, you know, I'm not a trained vocalist, but I consider myself to be, you know, good at what I do. I'm like, even for me to be like, whoa, this is intense. Yeah.
Press subscribe and you'll get more episodes with members of Kraftwerk, Radiohead, Fleetwood Mac and Guns N' Roses.
He'll be singing a song and, again, playing the anticipation role. One of the songs we did on the 2018 Shiny and Oh So Bright tour, which was when we played sold out Madison Square Garden and Wembley and all these, you know, wonderful, wonderful arenas and places. You know, it would be in the middle of, you know, Space Oddity by David Bowie, and he'd just hold this note out and he'd just lean back and just be like, bah! And sing this note forever. And I never knew how long he was going to hold this note for, but I knew it was coming after the first performance and after a couple of rehearsals. So I'd always just be like playing along, you know, because I'm playing, you know, keys as well, because of course I play keys on that tour, not bass, because he asked me to play keys and I was like, all right. And he holds, you know, I just, you know, leading up to this bit and I just take this massive breath and I'm like, and then comes the note and I'm holding it and singing harmony with him through the whole note until he trails off. So I'm playing that listen, sing, you know, I'm bridging that, you know, millisecond of a gap between hearing him and when he's finishing, when he's coming into a word, when he's ramping in. If he's accidentally singing this verse instead of that verse or that line instead of that line, I'll hear the consonant and go, okay, I'll make the change with him, you know. But that's what I do. Be a professional. Like, that's the biggest advice that you can give to any artist, and I give it to myself all the time, is just be a professional. Show up, do your job, be nice, and just try and work as hard or harder than everyone else, and your work will speak for itself. It just will. People will be like, you know, if there's nothing to be said about you because you've just shown up and done a great job, that's great. You know, nobody wants a drama queen. Even if you are the star of whatever it is that you're doing, I don't think you ever earn the right to be just like a total jerk to anybody. You know, everybody's there working on the same project, whether it's your thing or their thing or whatever it is. Again, like I said, I always, you know, try to get to know the crew and all the people around, because they're there working their butts off as well. And to be acknowledged, even if it's just this little bit here and there, it's like everybody wants that. So I don't know. Just everything I have to say is just about being professional and being prepared.
And preparation is an interesting one. It's kind of interesting to explore what does specific preparation look like. So it's good. One thing to say, oh, it's good preparation. It's really nice that you drill down into it there. And what is the last hour before a big kind of arena show look like? Is it vocal warm-ups? Is it, you know, massages? Is it kind of going through songs? Is it you're still back at the hotel? Is it drinks? Is it, like, what does that last hour look like? And before a big show for you personally and the band to really, again, to you know, knock the socks off the audience?
Well, my day, on a touring day, generally you'll be busing, if it's an American tour, you'll be busing through most of the tour, which means you've got like your little sleeper cabin area with your little curtain. So not for the claustrophobic, tour buses are not for the claustrophobic, but you've got your little sleeper thing, you show up to the venue, or if it's a really short traverse from one city to another, you might only be on the bus for like 4 or 5 hours. So you might only sleep for like 2 hours. Then you get off the bus, you check into a hotel, then you go back to sleep, and then you wake up, and then you work out when you're going to be transited to the venue. My go-to is always just like sleep for a few hours and be transited to the venue so that I can have lunch there, because then it's another meal I'm not paying for. And like, I hate to be that person, but I'm like, it's another meal I'm not paying for. You go there, you get your lunch, and then it's like, then I can go through, well, then I can get ready. I can go through my songs. Maybe I've got a couple of hours I could write some songs, or like when I'm on the road a lot, I'm still playing the, it's like I feel like I'm a guided tour sometimes. Like the way that I share stuff with the audience or with fans is just like, I know I'm not Billy Corgan. I'm not, you know, I'm not Madonna. I'm not like this huge anything, but I can show what it's like to live this life, and it's still exciting, surprising, and I'm grateful for it. So I get to showcase that part with my audience. So I'm always kind of documenting stuff as I go if I'm on tour. So I'm taking photos. This is my dressing room today. It's kind of a big one, you know, and it'll like might say my name on the wall or what time sound check is, blah, blah, blah. Because generally you show up, like for me, I'll have my lunch, get a little bit ready, or go maybe noodle through some songs for whatever reason I am. Sound check is usually at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, or might be later than that, depends on who's opening and when sound check is after that. But then you'll do like early dinner, and then it's getting ready, like full dress ready, and then I'll do like a proper run through of stuff that terrifies me to play live. So I'll be just playing all the stuff that, you know, the songs that are really hard for me to play, I'll just go through those a bunch. I don't, you know, I'll usually do that up until about like half an hour before showtime. I'll be going through stuff. Then I'll take a minute just to kind of just, you know, finish getting ready, you know, put all the hairspray on or whatever it is, and then I'm good to go. But I'll generally be practicing almost right up until whatever. It's different if I'm playing my songs. My songs are my songs. But knowing I'm literally playing with Billy Corgan, one of the best guitarists in the world, you know, Jimmy Chamberlain, one of the best drummers in the world. Like, I'm playing with these exceptional musicians, and I'm playing keys, which is my third best instrument or whatever, and I'm a vocalist, so but I'm still practicing, because I want to make sure that I play the instrument part the best that I possibly can, because again, it's not, yeah, I'm there as much as a vocalist as I am as a keyboard player or whatever else I'm playing.
How do you use the time on the songs that you don't feature on? So like, I think on the last tour, you pretty much were staged for most of it, but there's been other shows, I think, where you've kind of gone off and come on.
Oh, yeah.
How do you deal with that time? Or is it just a case of just to sit back, relax and just watch from the side?
Well, sometimes, I mean, like on the Shiny tour, which was almost a full 3.5 hour show. Yeah.
I watched it earlier.
Yeah. It was a marathon, and I got to get off stage for a couple of the real rocker songs. So probably 4 to 6 songs through the set, I was off. If it's just a couple of songs, I'll literally just stand there side stage and chat to like the guitar techs or whatever it is, or high five them. They've got all their own little strange rituals that I sort of became part of too, which is kind of fun, which was like, you know, random soda of the night. So they open the cooler, and it's like, I ended up buying them a couple at one point during one of the tours, just to add to the, because I found a really cool sort of old school candy shop, and I just bought a couple of really strange sodas for them just to throw into the mix. But like, you know, they have like the little kind of throwaway shot glasses of like the soda, and everyone gets a little taster of this really strange flavored sodas. So in my off time off stage, that's one of the things I would do. If I was literally off stage for two songs or three songs, I might have guests backstage, and I might have invited them backstage to be like, if you get tired during the show and you need to come sit down because it's a long show, you know, feel free to come back to, you know, to my dressing room, and I'll come back and see you during this song, and then I'll scoot out again. Sometimes I would go back to the dressing room to literally go through something one more time because it's terrifying, or I'd fix my hair, or if it's, you know, 7,000 degrees in some hot city somewhere. It's like I might, you know, touching up my makeup or grabbing a corn chip or something to eat because it's a three-hour show. It's long. It's like it's exhausting and you get hungry and all these things. But, yeah, I would generally stand there for the most part side stage and just watch while I was off stage. But for the shorter tours, like the European tour we did in 2019, I was, you know, I think I was on for the whole thing except for one song if they threw in a random other song, but they were only like an hour and a half shows, so I was just there.
If you for the next, like, you know, next time you go to play with them and they say, oh, we want to play this particular song off this particular record, is it your job to go and find kind of the synth sound and try and replicate that, or is someone else doing that and you just have to play the part? Like, how does that work? Because it must be quite difficult just to find stuff that's from so long ago and actually get it as accurate as you can. Is that down to you, or is that
both? For the most part, they'll pick out the synth sounds that they want and they've already been programmed into, because often it was playing a Mellotron. It was playing Mellotron for one thing. On one of the tours, I was doing Mellotron and B3 and also a piano, a clavinova over the other side of the stage. But this one was a little bit more dialed in. The last tour we did in Europe and also America, it was Mellotron, which is kind of an old school programmable. It's kind of programmable tape machine type thing. So that's physically sampled like flutes and trumpets and things like that. You know, like if you think of, think of a song like Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles. Think about like those flute sounds. Mm-hmm. Like that's like a Mellotron sound.
Yeah.
Okay. So if that makes sense to you. So Mellotron does this. It's kind of a very small keyboard and I've got the sounds and I'm just basically turning the dial to find the sounds that have been programmed in. And that's that. On, you know, the main keyboard that I would play, other songs may have been programmed in. On the last tour when we were in Europe, we were programming in a couple of sounds because we were still working through the set list and he wanted to throw in this cover or that cover, and it's like, well, you know, what sound? And then, you know, Billy wants to make sure it's the sound that he wants, and so he tweaks it to whatever he wants, and then I work with the, you know, the keyboard tech and we tweak it further so that it sounds right with the band. So it's not just, because you can play something on its own solo, just on its own, and be like, that sounds great, but then you hear it with the band and you're like, oh, it's got too much low end, or it's not poking out enough, or it's not enough of this, or whatever it is. So then it's tweaking it further. So it's a group effort. It's a group effort to really sort of dial those sounds in. Yeah, there's no simple. It's a group effort.
It's a group effort. One thing you said that's really striking from earlier is that when you've played a lot of shows, they've often been quite intimate, and having that interaction with the crowd is very important. How do you communicate with each other on stage effectively during those huge shows? Because, you know, that do you have like a secret code? Do you have like a system that works? You know, can you mute a mic and speak to each other, anything like that? Or is it nonverbal communication? Like, what tips for musicians who get themselves into that situation quite quickly, like you did? How would you best go about that?
It's non-verbal communication for the most part. We had moments where, very, very challenging moments in one of the tours where we started the tour behind the curtain playing live in the dark with pencil lit lights so that we were playing the introduction that was happening on the big screen at the front and nobody knew that we were playing it live. So we're basically in the dark, can barely see ourselves, our instruments or each other. That was a whole other thing. But for the most part, when you're on stage, you can see each other, and it might be one of those things where, like, Jimmy the drummer will be counting me in for a song. Like, I've got relative tempo, but, like, his job is to count me in, so he might be just pointing at me going, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I start the song because there's various songs that I'm starting, and most of the stuff is not to click track. You know, there's, you know, a lot of this, most – or at least half the stuff is not to click track at all. So there's just, we're just playing stuff. So he's counting me in so I can start this thing. And there's a couple of songs that happened where I was starting the songs just on keyboards, or it was one song where I literally just walk up and just start playing my part, and then everyone else has to work around me, which is, again, just terrifying. If you know each other's signals, like, we're ending the song, it's after this bar, you know, someone might raise an arm or whatever it is. But a lot of the songs that are like the big songs that may have some program stuff that's still on the track, we all, you know, anything that was just free time, you know, we already had, you know, you rehearse to death anyway. There's no nothing left up to chance. And, you know, in an arena show, nothing's left up to chance. And also nothing's left up to chance because there were video screens too. So the video screens are playing for X amount of time and they might reel down. And if you're playing to free time, but you're in relative time, the screen will go for the right amount of relative time. But then it's up to the person operating whatever to manually turn, you know, change the screen over to the next, you know, the next video, whatever it is. There's a lot of little variables here and there, but most of it is just making sure you've got each other, making sure it's like you're changing. I'm changing stages. I'm walking across the stage to go to the other piano, making sure I'm not stepping on anyone's leads or chords or unplugging anyone or I'm talking to the stagehand who's passing me an acoustic guitar. So I've got to go up front and play acoustic guitar and stand. Basically, you know, if you think about stage arrangement, you know, I'm coming up to play acoustic guitar in the center of the stage pretty much, you know, and James Iha's singing his song while Billy's going and having a costume change. Mm. So it's, you know, covering the stage in that sort of sensibility too. And I don't know, most of it's, you know, each other and you've communicated and you've rehearsed, but yeah, absolutely nothing is just left up to chance. Somebody is guiding someone through something usually.
Which gig have you played, either solo or with Smashing Pumpkins, do you wish you could have been in the audience for?
I don't know. I've had some really wild moments of playing stuff like, I wish I could have had like a bird's eye view of some things. Like there's so many people that have taken photos of stuff of the audience from like way back at the back of the field or arena or whatever. And you can kind of see what it would look like. You get that sort of insight to what it would have looked like. It's impossible to want to be in the audience while you're playing on stage because I can't comprehend listening to that. My brain can't compute that all at once. I did have a cool moment of opening up the European tour in this, I don't know, it wasn't an arena, it was just a very big theatre in Norway. It was in Oslo. The opening band, the singer got blood poisoning, which I can imagine is not fun and not a quick fix. You can't just be like, I'll put a Band-Aid on that and just go play the gig. It's not one of my old stories of like, oh, I've got, you know, tonsillitis, but I'm going to go sing this gig or whatever, like an idiot. He was violently ill, so they cancelled, you know, they cancelled basically their position in the tour because he was very, very sick. And so I got the knock on my dressing room door to, do I want to open the show? And this was given a couple of hours' notice. And it was like, you know, I've been rehearsing nothing but Smashing Pumpkins songs for a couple of months. And I'm like, who am I? Do I know my songs? So I did a quick rehearsal with myself, went and sound checked and played this acoustic show to a bunch of Norwegians that were very much expecting a metal band to be opening. And I'm out there playing my acoustic songs. And like some of them knew who I was. Like when I walked out, I heard a couple of like, Katie Cole or Katie. So a few people were kind of like got what I was doing. I explained who I was and I was basically like, it's me or no one. So that was fun. But once I, you know, again, told them a couple of stories and whatever it was, you know, you kind of, again, the personality thing can sort of do some of the work for you. And they had a good time. The audience were cheering quite loudly. And you know, and I got to come back out again and play the show, you know, as the keyboard player, you know, after, you know, got off the stage, quickly changed outfits again, and then jumped back on the stage to play the show. That would have been an interesting one to see because it was so random and it was very unexpected. And just, it was a lot of pressure just to be like, go do this thing now. Okay. And you're like, all right. But I've said yes to a lot of things in my career, my life, whatever it is that seem impossible or are impossible or all those things that I don't know. I don't know what's impossible now because I never thought, oh, I'll just go play a download festival. It's 100,000 people or, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe some rock stars are like, one day I'm going to, for me, I'm just like, I'm just happy to be doing music and telling stories that are interesting to me and engaging with people and having an emotional experience with people or eating some random food in some random country and whatever. I'm happy to just have those experiences, but that would have been, I think that would have been an interesting one to see. Another interesting one would have been on the, in Plainsong tour, Again, not singing my song, but singing and playing Malibu by Hole at the Ryman in Nashville, just because I'm in Nashville now and I sort of feel it's a home away from home. Like, I've lived in LA, I've lived in Nashville, and obviously lived in Melbourne and other places too, but it's kind of my home, it's my hometown now, I guess, because I live here. So being there and being at the Ryman and playing, you know, the Ryman's considered to be the mother church because it's a famous venue and has a huge history behind it. So playing and stepping on that stage was kind of a big one for me. And I had a few friends, you know, very close friends in the audience too. So that was kind of a big deal. So being able to see that moment, but again, I still got photos and some footage and whatever, but, you know, I don't know. I suppose those are two ones. It's a hard thing to comprehend though, seeing yourself, because it's like, I can't, it's like, scientifically possible.
what's the most important kind of piece of memorabilia that you own, like, or anything that you kind of picked up from a gig, or, you know, something important to you that, you know, if the house is burning down and everybody's okay, what's something that you'd grab that kind of really symbolizes or is a cherished memory around your time in the music industry?
I've got a lot of memorabilia. I have a snowboard that was given to me by one of the venues. It's still in a box. I actually had it as an auction. I had it as an auction item in my Kickstarter that I just had nobody bought it. So I've still got that. Just because I'm like, when am I going to go snowboarding? But it's super cool. But I've got a lot of memorabilia. I'm not really a sports fan, but like at a lot of the arenas that I played in, I was given sports jerseys. And so I've got like the tank jersey that's like from Chicago Bulls, the basketball team. I've got like a few of those that are kind of significant to me. When we played Madison Square Garden in New York, I got given, because you know, you go backstage and you've got your own dressing room, and then you're like, you see there's a gift there that's like for Katie, and you open it up and it was a Tiffany box, like the famous blue ribboned Tiffany box, and I open it up and I'm like, Madison Square Garden wants to marry me. No, I open it up and it's this big placard that's in silver that basically is printed. It's like, you can see it. It's like Smashing Pumpkins, sold out Madison Square Garden and blah, blah. It's just this, it's like an award from Tiffany. And I'm like, I'm never parting with that. I've got a few things like that that are memorabilia, things given to me from the venues, but symbolize the moment, the event, the gig, whatever it is. I've got a lot of things like that, but I think the memories are the things, it's sentimental to say this, my memories mean the most to me. That I do, because I can remember so many more things than I have as a physical representation of those things. So, I mean, I try to take photos in every city I'm in of every gig that I do, you know, eat something interesting or drink a coffee somewhere. I just try and do something in every city that I'm in so that I've got a memory outside of the hotel or whatever it is, or go to a museum in the city or go visit this thing or this landmark or whatever it is, walk up and take a photo of this weird thing. I'm like, okay, that's famous here. Okay. I've got a lot of those things. And yeah, I think it's the memories mean the most to me, but I do have some cool stuff, but yeah.
We're going to begin to wrap up in a moment. Last couple of questions. Do you have any career advice for other female musicians coming up through the industry? Because you talked about some of those early gigs in Melbourne and even probably through to today. There's some kind of challenging circumstances you may have been put into there. And, you know, it is a quite male-dominated industry and it's still to this day. So do you have any career advice for any female musicians coming through?
I have a lot. And they're none of the things that were ever told to me, because I didn't have really anybody that could tell me things, I suppose. I think as a woman or a girl, you have to kind of work harder than everyone else, I think. I think it's really safe to say that. It's difficult to say that, but your gender plays a very big role in the way that people see you, and it will always be that way. And sometimes it's to your advantage, because people will be like, you know, she looks good in a photo or whatever it is. Whatever the thing is that people will summarize about you to the reason that you're somewhere or doing something, you just have to accept that as a compliment. I've still had to work harder than, I mean, even as a solo artist, and I see other independent artists around me, I try to just be that person that's trying to learn something new about the thing that I'm doing, trying to create something new, trying to adapt, trying to show up early, don't be late to things, be nice to everyone, be the professional's professional. When people, again, when the thing that comes to mind about you, when people are talking about you or referencing you, It should always just be that you're nice and that you are doing a great job. It shouldn't be like, oh, she's good at whatever, but, you know, looks good at this or whatever it is. And looks come into it. They always do. It's part of the brand that you have. And it's not usually assessed when you're a male, like being looking this way or being that way, unless you're like some shirtless guy that's just like always got your shirt off and people want to talk about your abs or whatever it is. Usually your appearance does not factor in so much as a male. It's just about the job that you're doing. But as a woman, it will always factor in. It's always going to be there. It's always going to be following you around, what you look like, how old you are, all that stuff. I think you just have to embrace it as something that you can work with and do such a fiercely good job that people can't ever use that as a crutch, you know, but she's got, you know, but she's tall or but she looks this way or you can't be... It shouldn't be something that's ever thought of like that. Just show up, be early, be a pro, be nice, be thoughtful, listen, pay attention. You know, a lot of the time in the situations I've been in, especially with the Smashing Pumpkins or around Glen Campbell or other, you know, intensely creative people or musicians or icons I've worked with, they've got more wisdom, you know, in their little finger than I do in my whole being, because they've been out there and doing it longer and they just know stuff. So I try to take the, you know, work ethic of just show up, be courteous, listen, pay attention, be respectful. You know, even if you worked your butt off, you don't know everything. You just don't. And you probably won't ever know everything. But know enough to know that you deserve to be where you're at. And if you're uncomfortable with your performance or something about it, work harder at it. Practice, practice, practice. And when you've practiced, do that some more until it's automatic, until you can now play the song, the part, the gig. And the only thing that you need to learn offhand is anything that's randomly happening, any changes, the audience, the fluctuations in temperatures. You've been traveling, you're extremely tired and your brain's just shutting off because it's like, I can't, I haven't had coffee or I only got 3 hours or 4 hours of broken sleep and now we're playing another arena. Sometimes you'll be in those situations where the stress is going to take its toll. But the idea is just drink water, don't be a jerk. I mean, I don't drink on the road. I'm not a prude in that sense. Like, if you need to have a beer or whatever it is that you do, that's fine. But don't do it on stage. Don't do anything to excess. Anything across the board, don't do anything to excess. Drink more water than you want to because it will help you. Honestly, being professional is still the... I know that's not a quality. I know it's not to be like, oh, I'm generous and I'm compassionate and that's my quality. I listen to people and I'm empathetic. Those are qualities that I have. But as a professional, I have to say that being professional is a quality because when you show up and you're totally prepared to, you're prepared, you've learnt the songs. Okay, I'm now learning to adapt because the songs have changed or they've changed structure or arrangement or whatever it is, or you're now playing this, I'm now singing this part instead or whatever it is. To be prepared with that change, you can't be frazzled by it too. And people, and I hate to say this about my gender because I'm now speaking for all women across the globe, even though we've made such great strides to get out of the kitchen or whatever it is, it's still going to be looked at like you bring drama to the situation, or, you know, women are harder to work with because they need this or makeup or whatever it is that people will unconscious, like the unconscious bias that we have about women or about other races or whatever it is that we have. You just want to make sure that you do everything to make sure that that stuff is not even coming into play. Like you can't stop people from unconsciously thinking things about, you know, people or places, whatever it is. But when you show them by talking, by doing the things that are all professional, that stuff will gradually peter out of the forefront of their mind. That's kind of the biggest thing. Just give people no reason to doubt exactly why you're there. That's a really long answer.
Thank you for your transparency and your thoughts on that topic. When will we hear Things That Break Part 2?
Well, I've been gradually releasing the music that I recorded from that because I recorded a full album. I was going to say, I recorded a full record. That's not good English. I recorded a full album in the studio for that and put out 5 songs, which was part 1. Then I put out, I'm trying to think of the order I put out, but I put out Lie to Me and I put out Hands Tied and I Love You. I did a double A side, which is putting out 2 singles at once, which is Mile in My Shoes and Lullaby. And I still have 2 more songs from that that I haven't put out, which will be coming out this year. And again, I just finished a Kickstarter crowdfunder that was very successful. So I'm about to go in and record more music. So I now have music to, I have music to put out. I'll be putting out new music, but I love the fact that I'm going to be able to blend these 2 things together. Like it's really anything I do moving forward, like Things That Break was such a learning curve for me, as I said, talking through that marathon that I said about pre-production and songwriting and rewriting. That's really the way I've approached everything else moving forward. If a song like this, oh, this great song, let's cut this song. Okay, let's make sure it's the right version of the song first. So I'm now about to embark in doing some more studio stuff because of crowdfunding. But yes, the 2 remaining songs will be coming out this year. I think this year. Yeah.
Awesome. And do you think the so Smashing Pumpkins was supposed to play some shows with Guns N' Roses? What's your hopes for that to happen? You did again. You did an Instagram post saying I'm crying or I'm not crying. You're crying, kind of thing about.
Yeah, no.
Are you hoping that that can still happen, or is that just all up in the air? I'm guessing at the moment.
I'd say it's doubtful because you think when the world got cancelled, when the world got cancelled in 2020, like you think about all the shows that had to be rescheduled. I think of it in terms of like, because I know Guns N' Roses had a bunch of like South American and then European shows that they had to move, and then everything gets nudged kind of forward, and you're also dealing with tour. There's so many logistics involved that like the touring companies and then scheduling this tour and this, because there's only X amount of arenas, there's only X amount of stadiums, there's only X amount of, you know, amphitheaters. Finding how to, all these bands having been backlogged for like a year, it's like knowing that like Guns N' Roses and like Roger Waters and like these huge, you know, enormous, enormous bands are having to reschedule these massive tours, and we were supposed to be playing whatever it was, a month worth of stadiums with them. And like to me, again, like I was like the, I'm not crying, you're crying, because it's stadiums. And to me, that's another bucket list check for me of I've never played a stadium before. I was just excited about the premise of that, and also the premise of of Guns N' Roses, because it's cool. It's super cool to, you know, to have that experience. And like I obviously, you know, saw glimpses of Slash when we were doing like European shows, because we were playing all these rock festivals, and it was like, oh, there's Alice in Chains and there's, you know, just all these, it just, I have a lot of crazy, crazy memories. I'm hoping that that gets rescheduled, but I'm not sort of pinning my hopes on it too. I just don't know. And I know that there are so many other factors that come into play with playing live. There's just, in general, there's so much red tape with organizing a tour. Organizing a tour on this sort of scale is so big. And now organizing a tour or rescheduling a tour on this scale in a pandemic where there's still a lot of logistics and liabilities involved. I can't process all that information, so I don't have answers. I would love for it to happen, but if it doesn't happen, it's fine. Like I got to play a virtual show on Jimmy Fallon with the Smashing Pumpkins. Like I've got to play all these cool things, so I'm not, you know.
So listeners might not be aware, but like some of the things behind the scenes that are really impacted are, for instance, in the UK, a company who, one of the main companies that provide the kind of really big screens at the very visual shows, they've gone under. And so some of the other companies that are, you know, there's only a certain amount that do it to that level. There's just a huge demand for them. So I already know of bands who would be playing with massive backdrops who are now having to do reimagined versions of their gigs because they just simply don't have the visuals. It's things like that that people just are not considering. So, yeah,
It's exactly that. So there's a lot of factors that come into play. And obviously there's a big demand for live shows now, but there's still a lot of liabilities and things to consider that it doesn't – I still don't know how it's going to work moving forward, knowing that – you know, not everyone's vaccinated. There's a lot of things to think about. But in general, the logistics of rescheduling an entire tour with, you know, the amount of production that's involved with those things, like what you were saying with the screens and everything, but it's like the staging and then there's these huge crews and all the, you know, 10 to 20 trucks worth of whatever it is to set up this, blah, blah, blah. There's so much stuff that I would love for it to happen. But honestly, just getting out there, like I played my first live show back in Civilization with real people in three dimensions whenever it was like a week ago. And I got another gig coming up next month in a venue. And it's like I, even then just playing shows, I'm like, really? I'm really doing this for real? It's very strange to just, even though like I never stopped playing online shows, like I never stopped the performance part of me. So it's not like, oh, I haven't done this in a year or what. I've never stopped performing and learning songs and doing all this stuff. But it's that transition to being back in the physicality of the air's different. I can smell this person's french fries over there while I'm playing. Those little things come back into play into your senses, and that always, those mood things are really what I think people crave the most about live music. It's just like the, even if it's the uncomfortable moments where somebody bumps into you when they're getting to their seat or whatever, it's like those are the little sort of things that you don't realize you missed. You know, that's me. That's me thinking like that. So I'm just excited to get back out there and play shows. I don't care who with, really.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Katie, for your insight, your guidance, your candor, your transparency. You've played on songs that will mean a lot to a lot of people for decades and decades to come, maybe well after we are all around. So I think that's something you should take stock of and give yourself a massive pat on the back for. Best of luck with getting new material out. And we hope the tour with the Guns N' Roses goes ahead. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Enjoyed this immensely.
Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with The Beatles, Beyoncé, Elvis Presley and David Bowie.
This episode was scored, mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhughes. ES, and that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhughes. He's the man.